This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Today's show was pre-recorded, so we won't be taking any questions or comments.
The story of the Negro in America is the story of America. It is not a pretty story.
I'm a black man in a white world. Most of the white Americans I've ever encountered surely have nothing whatever against Negroes. That's really not the question. Really a kind of apathy and ignorance. You don't know what's happening on the other side of the world because you don't want to know.
In America, I was free only in battle, but never free to rest.
We need to take action, any kind of action, by any means necessary.
They needed us to pick the cotton, and now they don't need us anymore. Now they don't need us, they're going to kill us all off.
That was from the trailer for the film documentary I Am Not Your Negro, based on the words and work of author and activist James Baldwin. Baldwin started planning his next book, Remember This House, in 1979. It was going to be a personal account about the lives and assassinations of three of his close friends, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King Jr. But at the time of his death in 1987, Baldwin had written only 30 pages of his manuscript. In the documentary I Am Not Your Negro, filmmaker Raoul Peck envisions the book James Baldwin never finished. The National Underground Railroad Freedom Center is hosting a sold-out event on Friday to screen the documentary and hold a community discussion. Joining us to talk about the film and the work of James Baldwin are his niece, author, educator, and activist Aisha Karifa Smart, Director of Community Strategy with the Greater Cincinnati Foundation, Dr. Robin Martin, YWCA of Cincinnati Advocacy Manager Desiree Bennett, and National Underground Railroad Freedom Center Manager of Program Initiatives, Chris Miller. Aisha, good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And Desiree, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Robin and Chris, thanks everybody for being here today.
Thank you.
And Aisha, tell us about James Baldwin, your uncle. I mean, tell us about who he was and how influential he was.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because his influence 30 years after his passing has, of course, been experiencing a renaissance. He's being introduced to a new generation of people, young folks who are reading his books and being inspired by his life and the example that he led and his quotes. But of course, during his life, he was an extremely influential writer and civil rights activist who was able to act as witness and bridge many relationships, the fact that he was a gay man, a queer man, and he was able to have these incredible friendships with, you know, three very traditional, cisgendered heterosexual men, Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and Medgar Evers, was, you know, unprecedented. You know, they were able to embrace him and, see him as a brother in the struggle. And so his life and what he wrote and what he bore witness to in the civil rights movement is unprecedented. No one else holds the unique position that he held, entering in where he entered in the various intersections that he was able to speak from, you know, being black, being gay, and having been raised in Harlem. And having experienced racism firsthand in many different situations, he was able to rewrite and speak truth to power around those issues in a very unique way that no one else really could do.
Aisha, how many books did your uncle write?
Whoa. that's a hard question. Overall, he's known a lot for his essays. So there are a few books that are collections of his essays. There is something called The Cross of Redemption, edited by Randall Keenan. And that is a collection of his previously uncollected essays. So he wrote articles in Playboy for Playboy and, was featured on the cover of Time. In terms of his novels, there is Go Tell It on the Mountain, Giovanni's Room. There are many other books, like The Fire Next Time is one long essay. So there are so many books. I really couldn't tell you how many, but I'm sure if someone chose to Google, there would be, you know, a literary list of all of the books that he published, because he also published overseas in France and Turkey and things of that sort.
So, of course, he was working on the book Remember This House. That was 1979. Right. That was he never was able to finish the book. And that's what led up to the movie, I Am Not, the documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, correct?
Correct, but also Raoul Peck, who's an incredible filmmaker, and he has a list of incredible films that I encourage other people to see. Fatal Assistance, which is about the earthquake in Haiti, the post work that was happening in Haiti, and also Malap Tropical, and also famously a documentary and a feature film about Patrice Lumumba. His films are incredible. But the book the movie is based on the unfinished manuscript, the 30-page of Remember This House, but it also is based on my uncle's book called The Devil Finds Work, which is a critical analysis of Hollywood and the movies. And how white images of purity juxtaposed to black images of inferiority and degradation impact the consciousness of people in America in terms of race and how we interact. So there are other writings, because Raoul had access to all of the papers, you know, personal letters. So it is mostly based on the 30 pages of the unfinished manuscript, but he also used other works to bring us what we have now in terms of the documentary, I Am Not Your Negro.
Chris, tell us more about that documentary. What's the intent of the documentary? What's the message of the documentary?
I believe with most documentaries, it's a vehicle to spark conversation, to challenge you, and to inspire you in some way, for you to evaluate not only our communities, but also individually, personally. You really do need to look inward in how you are conducting yourself and how you are behaving. And I think James Baldwin is one of those brilliant icons, and often they are not appreciated when they are here. They are more appreciated when they are gone. If you look at most of the people that we elevate and celebrate, at the time they were living, they were considered, you know, antagonists. They were considered that a lot of people were against what they were doing. You know, whether it's, you know, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Muhammad Ali, you know, the list goes on. But this particular documentary, I think it forces you to take a look at race, because race does transcend many aspects in our communities around, but also to look at those elements and the dynamics of having not only James Baldwin, but also three other individuals who are very iconic as well, and having them, this notion that a conversation between them. Often when we look at history, we think they operated in isolation. There was a lot of conversation. There was a lot of collaboration between respective leaders.
I would also add to that is that throughout the film, I had the pleasure of seeing it not once, but twice. I went back-to-back weeks. And what struck me was, as we think about, we often say how far we've come around race relations. And when you start to look at the documentary, you start to see in some respects, yes, we have come a long way. But in many other respects, we are at the exact same place, having the exact same conversation. And so I think the documentary was important, as Chris said, to really think about that we're still having the same conversation 30, 40, 50, 60, 80 years later, and we have a long way to still go.
Where do you think we've improved, Robin, and what areas still need a lot of work?
I think a lot of areas that need a lot of work is our economic system, the way we think about capitalism in itself. I think it's the way we think about oppression in communities of color. I think it's, as Aisha pointed out, even as we fight for gay rights and human rights around a number of issues, we have a long way to go in this country, even around police occupation. And even where we think about, as we think about protests, we think about protests around this country, around this world, on the ideal of protest and how it's shunned upon in some areas and not on the other, whether we talk about Iran or if we talk about Black Lives Matter, we need to have this conversation around civil disobedience and what it means to our overall collective freedom. And so, yes, we have, we do have a long way to go. The things that we have improved, though, is that we do have more civil liberties in jest, but we see that oftentimes that they are still threatened and that they are not given as we may think they are.
And Desiree, what about from your perspective? What areas still need work? What improvements have we seen since the start of the civil rights movement?
Like Robin said, echoing her, we do have a lot of improvements to make. In I Am Not Your Negro, as I was watching it, I realized that there's so many things that seem to ring true now. There's a lot of problems that are going on, but it's really great that now folks are wanting to get together, talk about these issues. And that's part of the reason why the YWCA wanted to be a part of this partnership and sponsor the follow-up community conversations to I Am Not Your Negro. So there'll be three follow-up conversations, one hosted by GCF, which will be at the Taft Center. I believe that's on March 10th. On April 25th, the YWCA will host one as well. We're still working on where that location will be. And then on June 16th, the Freedom Center will follow that up so that we can give folks a space to get together and talk through dialogue. And it'll be facilitated by Juanita Roberson, who is a facilitator and a life coach. So we're, you know, hoping to provide those spaces for folks.
So what in particular do you think makes the message of I Am Not Your Negro and James Baldwin's work, what do you think makes those so relevant to today specifically?
Well, we have folks that feel like their civil liberties are, they're not fully being accepted. And we need for folks to have these spaces to come together to talk about what those things are and why we are feeling this way.
Aisha, Chris mentioned that we don't appreciate many leaders until they've passed away. Do you think the new generation knows of and appreciates the work of your uncle?
Yes, I do. I feel like in many ways he was writing for this generation. You know, he said, and this is a direct quote, "I'm worth more dead than I am alive." He knew that he was way ahead of his time and that his writing was in many ways prophetic and prescient, you know, in ways that many people who write are writing for the future. They're writing for those who have yet to be born. And so he knew and understood that. And from what I can gather in terms of the many screenings that I've attended and spoken at, there's something about his voice and who he was and the type of life that he lived and his intersectionality, the way he carried himself through the world. He said, I'm not a nigger, I'm a man. And he stood up and he had a kind of confidence that people during the 60s and 70s weren't used to Black people having. And he refused to be treated in a certain way. So he went to Europe and he found his voice. And he found a place where he could express himself. And I think there's something about that that was considered avant-garde and a little out there for people during his generation. But the kids now can totally relate to that. They can totally relate to somebody who is out and proud and who stands up for who they are and who refused to be put into a box. So he is, you know, in many ways, icon for this generation. And not to say that he was celebrated. He was one of the most famous Black writers during his time. He appeared on the cover of Time magazine, you know, when other Black civil rights icons and writers had not been. So he was celebrated, but not to the level he is today. And so, yes, there is something unique about his perspective that really speaks to this generation. They really get him in many ways. And, you know, he loved, you know, young people. He taught at Amherst, you know, before he died. He loved teaching. A lot of his writing had to do with young people in education. He spoke out for Black English and the use of Black English in writing and criticized the educational system for the way they treated, you know, marginalized communities. So he has always had a connection to young people, to youth, and a lot of the work he did was around youth. There is a children's book that he wrote that will be republished in August that he wrote for my little brother called Little Man, Little Man. And a lot of people don't even know that he wrote a children's book. So yes, he had a definite connection and a definite way and voice that speaks to young people.
And this, you asked earlier about, you know, how far have we come? You know, if you think about us having this community conversation and this event here in Cincinnati right now, you know, GCF is sponsoring this as part of our equity work. And it's sold out in less than 3 weeks. And so that speaks to the magnitude and the sense of yearning that our community is seeking in order to learn and to be better and to grow. Right. This education and having the words of James Baldwin really speak to our community and give us a way in which we can really create and build community as a whole speaks volumes and how we prepare to move both our city and our country forward as well.
Are James Baldwin's writings still taught in schools today, Aisha?
No, unfortunately, much of his writings, they were, you know, in the 70s and 80s, you know, certain of his books were required writing in English classes in middle schools and high schools. And part of my work, I believe, is to reintroduce his works into the educational system because he has been, for the most part, phased out. And a lot of it just has to do with the new way that English is being taught. You know, kids are not reading entire books. They're not being required in many public schools to have a reading list and to read as rigorously as we used to, you know, where we had to do book reports and read, you know, various books and report on them. The shift is, and then there's just also been this backlash against certain books, and certain books are being banned. And my uncle's books are one of them, you know, with the whole thing that was happening in Arizona and Texas and the new language around, you know, the slave trade, the triangular trade versus the slave trade. And, you know, there's certain books that are considered threatening because they deal very openly with sexuality, race, racism. So there are various reasons why his work is no longer being taught, but because a new generation is discovering him, I am hopeful that we can get some of that reintroduced to school systems or just, you know, independent educators and getting people to just, you know, young people to read his works more.
I would say that is indeed an ongoing issue, especially from a public historian type of perspective. The educational system to have the presence of Black faces or the Black stories within the curriculum has been an ongoing challenge. I've seen that personally with daughters who are in school, and most of the individuals of color that were significant in developing and shaping America, most of that they get from me or their mother. They don't get it right in school. So if you have a child, whether the race of the child that's growing up in a home and their parents don't have that knowledge and the school isn't providing it, and therefore that child will not have any education whatsoever about these dynamics dealing with race. They will not see Black brilliance reflected in history until they go to a museum or if they come to public program like this. And so hopefully that's one of the things that I hope that will change, that needs to change as far as of having that, because it impacts not only children of color, but it also impacts white children as well, because they see these shades of brilliance, you know, over that have shaped the country. And so that also reshapes their consciousness of how they view race and gender.
Chris, was there anything in the documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, was there anything that came as a surprise to you or a revelation to you?
That's a good question. I, to be quite honest, not really surprised. To be fair, I mean, I've read countless narratives. It's a part of outside of any scholarly work. It's just a part of who I am. So I won't say anything surprising. I was as an English major, I was very familiar with James Baldwin. So I enjoy writing myself. And part of being a writer is you look at those iconic literary figures like James Baldwin. And so you research them, you learn, you know, Paul Laurence Dunbar, I can go on and so forth. So I can't really say for me anything was surprising.
Robin, you saw it too. Did anything come as a revelation?
The most telling piece of it was the end of the movie. And if you haven't seen it, I would hate to give it away. But Mr. Baldwin clearly says, I'm not your Negro. And the ending statement, he said, so for America, for us to really, really heal, we're going to have to figure out why do we create the Negro? And more importantly, why do we still need it to exist? That very profound statement really is at the crux of how we should start a dialogue of healing around race, racism, and racist ideas in America. So for me, that was one of the most profound statements in the movie. And so it was very telling.
Yeah.
And so for me, I'm not a historian. And in recent years, I've really had this need to just learn more, you know, about my history and about African-American history. And I was kind of surprised about the relationship that Malcolm X and Dr. Martin Luther King and also Medgar Evers that they had. I didn't know, you know, that they were so closely related.
Yeah,
so,
these were three men who were prominent in the civil rights movement, but they had three different styles, didn't they?
So. Right. Three different styles, three different stories. And what we learn in schools about them is that they were three separate people. Well, two, actually. You don't really even learn very much about Medgar Evers in school. And so that was surprising to me.
But I think that's critical as far as we look at today's shaping, that there's room for respective viewpoints and strategies in achieving a particular goal. There's room for Black Lives Matter. There's room for the NAACP. There's room for the Urban League. There's room for all these different voices. And so it's not that one voice is more critical than another. I think that's very important to understand that nuance when you talk about, you know, those dynamics.
I think one of the I think one of the really good things about us doing the screening is that I think folks will come and then they'll want to learn more, and so then they will seek out and even though some of these things aren't taught in schools, hopefully we'll be able to be, you know, a catalyst for that.
Okay. Yeah, can you give us the details for the screening again?
The screening is January the 19th. It begins at an 8 o'clock breakfast from 8 to about 8:45. The viewing of the film will start at 9. And then we'll have about a 30-minute Q&A and lecture from Aisha. And then we'll open it up to the community. Community, as Desiree said, the community will have an opportunity to sign up for three subsequent events so that we can continue to have the conversation openly in our community.
Aisha, thank you for joining us today. And Desiree, Robin, and Chris, thank you as well for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. Looking forward to a successful event.
Author, activist, and niece of James Baldwin, Aisha Kharifa Smart. Director of Community Strategy with the Greater Cincinnati Foundation, Dr. Robin Martin. YWCA of Cincinnati Advocacy Manager, Desiree Bennett. And National Underground Railroad Freedom Center Manager of Program Initiatives, Chris Miller. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Josh Elstrow was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next on 91.7 WVXU.